Hi, this is Scott.
This is Pat.
You want to stick around for this week's Hanson McLean's Money Matters, but you're going to talk with Paul Irving, Director of the American Society of Aging.
We're going to talk a little bit about tax strategies for heavily concentrated positions in your portfolio, and who doesn't want to miss that?
And some of the dangers of following gurus who think they can predict market cycles. So stick around for Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
And join us at 888-2-HANSON, 888-2-HANSON.
Providing guidance as you plan and transition into retirement for over two decades, here's Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean. Thanks for joining us.
Right, glad you're here with us on this weekend, or maybe you're listening to our podcast that you subscribe to that's delivered to you each week. Whatever the case, we are glad you're here with us. Myself and my co-host, we are both financial advisors. Certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant. We spend our week meeting with people like yourself and come here on the weekends to be your financial advisors on the air. And we always enjoy having you along as we talk about, we can just, Pat and I can talk between us for a lot, hours on end, but we appreciate having you along.
And you can join the show at 888-2-HANSON if you have a financial question you'd like, you know, reviewed, answered, shared. 888-2-HANSON to
That's right.
join the show.
And I'd love to take your call and
get you on the air.
Yeah, that would be good to have you. So anyway, this is Thanksgiving's coming up this weekend.
Yeah.
Do you have kids coming home from?
I do.
That sounds boring, actually. Now, you know what? I'm sitting there talking about this. I'm thinking, it reminds me of like a Saturday Night Live sketch where they do public radio. Alec Baldwin on the yeah, that's what it just talking about. So, how was your day?
It was fine. It was okay. Fine. Yes, anyway. They're coming home. Yes, we're having people. Yes, we're gonna do the whole Thanksgiving thing.
Yeah. So
good.
All right. Yeah, but I got kids coming home from school and all that good stuff. Yeah. So anyway, we're a financial program. Talk about financial matters.
Take your calls, 888-2-HANSON.
Answer your questions.
So, hey, Scott, I just real quickly, on our website, there is a video that we did months ago where a guy kept calling my cell number and saying he was from the IRS and that I owed him money and I was going to go to jail. So for fun, we were in the studio one day and I said, let's call this guy back and get him on the air and see what he has to say. So it's about a 8 or 9 minute video, I think.
Painful. I found it painful because I'm watching one human trying to scam another human.
But you can watch it on our website, moneymatters.com. But the IRS apparently went to India and arrested a bunch of these people. And the scam is
I remember reading
much,
that a few weeks ago.
It's pretty much come to an end. The number of reports about the scam are down by 95%. So the number
Isn't
of
that amazing?
It became quite a cottage industry.
And it was like one company.
Well, it's like the mortgage industry. They spawn other companies. It's
yeah, but this they arrested one group and things.
That was a big, big group. Yes. Yeah. And I don't think it's fair to compare it to the mortgage industry. My point being.
No, that's what I'm like. Where are you going with this?
My point being is that if you look at where the mortgages company started from, they all in Orange County. But what's that?
So, no, I was talking, it reminded me, I was having a conversation with a client who had purchased a home with cash and then had decided to have a mortgage on. He was going to get a mortgage and the process was just kind of a pain. So it's just like, I'll just use some cash, purchased a house and wanted to get a mortgage on it. And he told the mortgage broker near the end, he said he only needed couple hundred thousand. And the mortgage broker told him that he had to get $418,000, the conforming limit or something along those lines. And basically told this guy.
Which isn't true.
Right. And by the way, it happened to be, there's a financial services company, large bank that's been in the news lately about cross-selling.
Yeah.
Might have been from that bank, but.
They're, so.
Was not true. He ended up having a larger loan than he.
But did he just pay it back quickly? Is that how it?
Well, it's more complicated. But
so anyway,
my point is, when you said not fair to bring in the mortgage industry, I'm thinking sometimes they develop their reputation.
My point being is that a large portion of the mortgage industry started in Southern California because they spawned their own competition. But that's what happened with these India call centers. But if you go to our website, moneymatters.com, I've had 176,000 views on my little video. I'm kind of a internet star now. I've gone viral sensation. I can't wait to tell my kids. I can't wait to tell my kids when we, over Christmas or over Thanksgiving break, that their father has turned into a viral sensation on the internet. 176,000. How many views do you have on your little videos?
Seven.
Seven?
I have seven views.
And 176,000. I'd like you to become a part of that.
You're going
to
be like Gangman style.
I'd like you to become a part of that community by going to moneymatters.com and viewing the video.
You feel good about that then, do you?
I do. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So I found this article. So there's a guy named John Paulson who accurately predicted and bet on the subprime mortgage crisis.
And cleaned up.
Yeah. Made billions. Hedge fund guy.
Made
billions.
Actually had them manufacturing their own products, Wall Street, and then buying, betting against them.
And so one of the things we've talked about in this program is we do not believe it's possible to predict market cycles. And we believe that if you do, it's probably just luck.
I wouldn't call it luck. It's because they actually made the bet that he made that money on the mortgage. The chances of you pulling those types of bets off successfully in a row are very difficult.
So his hedge fund, which he was managing $38 billion in 2011, became quite large. So his hedge fund, remember, hit a home run. He has done horribly lately. So he began betting on drug company investments. And betting that they're going to do Valiant.
Valiant was one of his big ones.
Yes, which was in the news because they had
because they jacked up. They were buying these almost generic or close to generic products and just jacking the prices up.
So here's in order to kind of hedge his bet, what he was doing this year is going long on these pharmaceutical companies while selling short the rest of the market.
So he was saying
one
part of the market.
So in other words, he was saying that the whole market's overvalued and it's going to go down, except pharmaceuticals are going to go up. So I'm going to own pharmaceuticals and sell short everything else.
Wow, that is a that.
And
is,
what happened?
That is a
the
big
opposite
bet.
Happened. The stock market continued to rise and some of the drug company stocks he held were just disasters.
How big were his losses?
Well, as of it looked. I don't know. He had $38 billion in 2011, and today he's got about $12
billion. Yeah.
So some was investors firing him, of course.
Yes, because his performance.
But here, we bring this up not because to pick on John Paulson, but really to state, look, just because someone calls a market right the first time does not mean they're going to call it correctly the second time, and don't chase money. The people who invested with him, by and large, were not the ones early.
They were the ones that... after he had made the money in the mortgage and thought John Paulson was absolutely brilliant.
And they haven't fared so well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. Although hedge funds as a whole
haven't fared
so well.
That is.
And I always just question whether it's just the regulatory environment that allows that the regulators came down on the hedge funds so hard in the last few years.
No. Well, first of all, it should be a zero sum game like the rest of the
market,
right?
But, there were obviously some hedge funds that were trading in inside information because people went
true.
To prison.
Yeah.
And then after they have gone to prison, like most of the industry has fallen apart. So you just wonder, were all of them trading on inside information and now no one does? So that it's a level? That's just me thinking out loud.
Yeah.
On the radio.
Anyway, good lesson.
Thousands of people.
Good lesson to remember, though, is not following these gurus, because if they hit it right the first time, they're probably not going to the second time. So, well, let's talk the new view of retirement. On this week's show, we have Paul Irving. He's the chairman of the Milken Institute Center for the Future of Aging and vice chair of encore.org. We'll be chatting with us about the future of retirement and also some of the changing in the aging population. So, Paul, welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Hi, Pat and Scott. How are you?
We are fantastic today. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're glad you're here because, you know, you're quite the expert in this area. There's several experts, but you've had a number of accolades over the years, and you contribute to the Wall Street Journal and the Huffington Post and a number of different things. But how has the traditional view of retirement changed, in your opinion?
Well, I think there's a range of polling and other information that's showing that retirement preferences, people's inclinations are changing over the years. Those changes very much continue. This is not just true of baby boomers, but it's true of Gen X and millennials. Traditional retirement, this notion of a life of leisure, kind of, you know, leaving your home and heading for a beach community to play golf and shuffleboard, maybe to eat at a rec center, is very much a reflection of yesterday's point of view. Older adults today say that they want to remain engaged, that they want to oftentimes continue to work. Some of that is for financial need, but often it's because they want to continue to have challenge and meaning and purpose in their lives. And so in many ways, the view of the financial services industry about retirement hasn't caught up with what we know people's changing inclinations are.
I would say not only the views, the tools as well. Most of the financial planning programs out there all seem to have this kind of, what's your retirement date? What's
exactly
the number
right.
going to be, and assumes that someone's going to check out and never engage in any sort of vocational employment again.
Yeah, and it also assumes that there's some kind of that older people are somehow homogeneous. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, we understand that young people are very different from each other, middle-aged people are very different from each other, but for some reason, as we get older, the view seems to be that older people become all alike, that they have the same aspirations, the same needs, and the same timetable. And of course, nothing could be not only further from the truth, but more absurd. Actually, as life goes on, we become more complex, more nuanced, more certain of our points of view. Our tastes are more refined. But we tend to, in many, many sad ways, and it's a product of deeply held ageism, we tend to kind of dumb down expectations for older people. And I will tell you that older people are just as diverse, if not more diverse, than any other age group in any other population.
Oh, even inside the relationships with the husband and wife, you can't get more diverse than what you see. And people that have been married for 40 years come into your office and you ask them, because they'll go at it about their opinions about retirement. One guy's, I'm never going to do it. And she's like, we're going to know. We're sitting on the beach.
Yeah, well, look, this is one of the reasons why these kinds of conversations really should happen, not just at the point of retirement or just before. They should happen throughout life. You know, we kind of all grow up with a series of patterns, expectations about what our life course is going to be, when we're going to get educated, and maybe when we're going to get married and have families, and what our professional lives, our work lives are going to be, and when we're going to retire. But again, the facts demonstrate that oftentimes those expectations have nothing to do with what really happens. So, you know, I think one of the imperatives for your industry, frankly, guys, is the need to figure out more individuated conversations that are really, really tailored to the individual needs and aspirations and goals and inclinations of the people with whom you interact. You know, I often say, I gave a speech not too long ago to some leaders in the pension business, and I said that target date funds, which are, as you know, these funds kind of designed for a series of expectations in life, you know, heavily focused on equities earlier in life, more concentrated in bonds later in life, assume a certain life pattern. But that life pattern makes sense for some people. Some people may want to head off for the beach early in life, and many, many others, an increasing number, want to want to be carried out horizontally. I mean, want to work their entire lives. So why in the world should kind of one product, you know, seem to be right for all 25-year-olds or 35-year-olds or 45-year-olds when all those people are dramatically different? So what we need, and I'll just, you know, finish the quick thought, what we need is a way to figure out how to have a deeper dive, a deeper conversation with people about what they really want to do with their lives. And that conversation is not just a conversation for older people, it's a conversation for younger people as well.
Do you think that the economic incentives to retire should be changed? Like Social
like
62,
Security,
like at 62 at Social Security.
There are a lot of questions about whether the age of Social Security should be changed. You have to remember when Social Security was adopted in the United States in the 30s, the average age of the average longevity of Americans was between 61 and 62 years old. So Social Security was envisioned as this kind of extraordinary program for people who outlive normal lifespans.
The few that made it.
Would be there as an expectation. And today we know not only that average lifespans are about 80 in the United States, but we know that in generations to come, that's going to extend significantly. And I suspect that in your kind of client group, a high percentage are living into their 90s and more are becoming centenarians. So the design of that, which was an import from Germany in the 30s, may not make sense anymore. But the problem is if you're going to change the time and the circumstances under which people can have the safety of Social Security, you also have to change work norms, right? You also have to encourage and enable employers to retain people later in life. We have to change the kind of get the gold watch and fall off the cliff notion of retirement and start to think about things like transitional retirement.
Or phased retirement, correct?
Phased retirements, shared work arrangements. Some of these things are happening in some companies in America. They're happening in some other companies in other areas of the world. But this has to become again a norm. And I think very honestly, we have tended to kind of celebrate retirement as a goal. There's an awful lot of evidence that retirement is not only not good for your wealth, it's not good for your health. At least traditional retirement, where you're kind of disengaged and removed and your roles are diminished. So I think one of the things we got to think about as a culture is how do we celebrate work? How do we celebrate the notion that actually challenge and lifelong learning and ongoing, you know, kind of ongoing need to be involved are really not only good for you, but they're good for the broader society.
We're speaking with Paul Irving. He's the vice chairman of Encore.org here at Hanson McLean. And so it's interesting, Paul, because one of the things that we've talked about, oftentimes we'll talk with someone in their 50s. It's quite frequently someone doesn't do much retirement planning until maybe their kids are in college or out of college. And it's like, oh, crap, we got to get our life together. So they'll come and visit with a financial advisor. And oftentimes we'll have a conversation with someone and they're not liking their work anymore. And so they're trying to figure out how quickly they can retire to get out of their job. And one of the things we try to counsel people on is maybe we should consider doing something different. Even if it meant that you had to delay your retirement and couldn't afford to save as much, not make as much money, to us it's like maybe that would be a more purposeful way to spend your next decade.
It's at least it's worth a conversation.
It absolutely is, and the challenge for society, the challenge for all of us, is. Again, we have a supply demand mismatch. We have a demand for talent. We have a demand for experience. We have a demand for service and volunteership and a whole series of other things. And we have this massive supply, as we know, of older adults, not just in America but across the world. Again, the data suggests most of them, seeking ongoing engagement, continuing opportunity to work, continuing opportunity to add value. So the question is, how do we connect the dots? And I think that's something we're missing. We don't yet have the Match.com or
no.
the kind of work dating site as you would to connect older people who aspire to do new things. Again, using your example, somebody who may have had have had a job that they find frustrating or that they want to change and now want to do something else. What are their pathways? How do they find them? And those pathways really are just in the very early stages of beginning to be built, and we have to accelerate them. You know, there's been a lot of discussion of late about changing physical infrastructure, right? Bridges and airports and tunnels and things like that. Well, this is one kind of infrastructure that needs to be built and built quickly in light of the changing demography, and that is a way for people to get from where they are to where they want to be in a more natural, comfortable, understandable way. And I promise you, working in this field and spending a lot of time in it, that gap is a gap that is an urgent challenge for all of us, and frankly a challenge for the country, and a challenge for many, many countries with aging societies around the world.
So have we seen, for example, is Japan doing much in that area? Because obviously Japan's the one we all look at.
You know, Japan has great challenges, and I would say Japan is innovative in the sense that it's trying to figure out ways to keep older people healthier and more engaged, but it certainly hasn't solved its problems. And Japan is the developed society with the oldest population in the world, as we know. But you know, don't think it stops with Japan. It's China and Korea and much of South Asia and
much of the world,
all of Europe,
all of Europe,
and virtually all of Latin America. So really, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa and a little pocket in the Middle East, almost all the world is aging, and many of these problems are not just American problems.
I read a book maybe a year or two ago, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, and it's the whole kind of premise that people aren't having kids anymore. It's just very small pockets in the world are having multiple kids. Usually it's just one or two anymore.
So it gets into an allocation resource problem, correct? We have these great resources that are going to seed because they're not.
We're based on old models.
Paul, is this the work?
I mean, look, global aging is a product both of reduced fertility, lower birth rates, and of increasing longevity, improvements in science and medicine and safety. But if you think about it, so we've got a paradox, which is that science has accomplished probably the most amazing thing in the history of humankind, and that is in the last 125, 150 years, it's doubled lifespans. Science has done its part, but social science has a long way to go. We've got this extra time, what some call the longevity dividend, and we haven't figured out what to do with it. And that's a tragedy in many respects. You know, in prior generations, for most of human history, people lived 20 or 30 years.
That's right.
And now we not only are living into our 70s and 80s and 90s, we have the prospect in the wake of the decoding of the human genome for even much longer lives. But I think the question we all have to ask is, what the heck are we going to do with it? And of course, one of the things that you're involved in is how are we going to finance it?
Well, if some of the things are going to live to 110 because of new sciences coming on, it's not going to be retiring at 65.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
It better not be. I mean, we really people you know, economists talk about dependency ratios. That is the assumed number of people who were in employment age in comparison to the people who were assumed not to be of employment age. And we have to change that basic economic concept. We have to stretch the number of working years, and again, we have to celebrate work. We have to talk to our kids about it. So I'll challenge the two of you since I do this regularly, and that is to think about a new word. Is the word retirement the right word, or you know, as I sometimes call it, the R word, or is it a transition or transformation or refocus, rewiring? It's really something else. It's not this notion of a life on a beach. It's not this notion of a segregated life with single age people waiting to die. It's how do you stay productive and engaged and continue to do new and creative things, even if you can't run quite as fast or your eyesight isn't quite as good. You've got other things to offer.
You certainly do.
Stronger.
And you've got a lot of wisdom that 25-year-old doesn't necessarily have. So, hey, Paul, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program. Paul Irving, he's the chairman of the Milken Institute Center. And there'll be a link here at our website, moneymatters.com, which should take you to, you can learn more about Paul Irving as well, encore.org, where he is the vice chairman of that. So it's been a pleasure having you on, Paul. And keep up the fight.
We will do it. You too.
Yeah, all right. No, appreciate it. Really interesting.
Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for the time.
Yeah, glad you're.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Anyways,
that was great.
It is.
Lots of people thinking about this. Some people changing their behavior.
That's right. And some companies will start changing their behaviors as well. Particularly when they can't find good workers. So yeah. Why don't I just
get someone that actually has experience?
Why don't I let those people leave?
Get back here.
Get back. Anyway, we're taking a quick break. Stick around for more Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Back to one of the longest-running financial programs. Here's Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
That's right. Welcome back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. Scott Hanson here with you.
Pat McLean.
If you want to be part of the program, got a question for us, like be on the air. By the way, when someone joins us on the air, we take that clip, read it, the segment you're on, and we'll send you an email with that clip so you can listen to the answer again. You can forward it on to your friends.
Friends, family.
We do a video, too. You have the video podcast. You can take the video section of it and show how famous you are.
Yeah, it's kind of a brush with greatness.
Yes. It's super exciting.
It is so much.
I mean, how many times are you on a radio program?
Where?
And then it gets transferred onto a podcast, and a video podcast, nonetheless, where you can actually see the hosts
talking
into the mic.
It's like,
it's so exciting.
It's like a radio show done with cameras in the room.
It's so exciting.
So, if you'd like to join the show, 888-2-HANSEN. That's 888-2-HANSEN. And whether you're just beginning, like you're just starting, my son, who is a senior in high school at 18, I had a small...
That's your middle son.
My third child, yes. Yes. Middle son. I put some money in an UGMA when they were little. They put some in and I matched them.
Into a uniform gift to Minors Act.
Correct. Thank you for speaking English.
But I was kind of surprised you said that. Actually, it's because that's how you have to title it.
I had to title it like that.
As I'm saying that, I'm thinking I had the same thing set up for my kids.
So I...
my daughter spent it because she always spends money as soon as possible. My son still has his.
Oh, So I matched it. So when he turned 18, I actually...
Was there a lot of money?
All in. I think we put $1,000. He put $500. I matched him $500 or 15 years ago.
And you've grown it to $900.
This is not to recommend or deny, disclaimer, it was about $2,200. I think we put $1,000 in. So he's turning 18 this month, so I liquidated and I put it in his checking account and he said, or his bank savings account, and he said...
Why'd you do that?
Because I want him to start making his own decisions. And he said the same thing. Why'd you do that? Why'd you take it out? I said, well, we were going to change title on it, and I want you to start making your own decisions. And he said to me, well, you know, I'm getting to be 18. I'm going to have to start diversifying this portfolio. So he said that he's going to go to a discount broker and open up a small account and start.
You're kidding. Investing.
No. Well, my 20-year-old has an account at, I think, E-Trade or someone like that, where he actually trades, which actually I get quite the kick out of because
it's a good.
He takes heavily concentrated positions.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's beautiful because he's going to end up losing money.
That's what I tell him.
And then it'll be a good lesson.
I said, I'm glad you're doing it with your.
You know what's interesting? So here's what's interesting. Here's what we talk about in the firm. So just to kind of give you a. We believe it's important for people to have their own experiences with investing, both making money and losing money. And there's no long-term investor that has not lost on an investment.
Had a period of time where they have not lost some money.
Some poor choice, that sort of thing. And it's so much better for people to have those lessons earlier in life, because it is really challenging if you've never really had to make an investment decision, or maybe the only thing you've ever done is your 401k and you've never paid attention to it. And suddenly you inherit a couple $100,000.
Sudden wealth.
It is extremely challenging.
Because you have a perception of how you're supposed to, like how rich people, because sudden wealth oftentimes they'll say, well, rich people I've heard do it like this. Well, rich people typically, other than the companies that they've started or had a role in, have normally pretty diversified portfolio. They're not heavily concentrated. But I get a kick out of my kids having this conversation with them because they're now starting to make these investment decisions by themselves. Obviously, probably not a normal family discussion since I am an investment advisor and they actually get, you know.
And you were able to match their own savings.
That's correct. That's correct. And we have these conversations on an ongoing basis. They, you know, about how important it is to actually understand how money works. Because some people know how to make money. They don't know how to keep it, save it, or invest it.
That's very much true. Just because you have a friend or a family member that's done well financially in their career does not mean that they know what they're doing when it comes to investments.
And that is quite normal.
And particularly if you find some certain professions that they tend to...
Say it.
Physicians.
Oh, there we go.
Okay.
Most of physicians would agree.
Yeah. They tend to...
Not all. We have many clients that are great,
and I don't know
great
if it's,
clients, great clients.
I don't know if it's... I mean, they take...
I don't
so
know
many
if they're
years
easily
of,
sold or...
I don't know. What they take so many years of education, and obviously... you know, I think one thing when you're a physician, you've got someone who's ill coming to you. There's a lot of hope and trust they put in a physician, right?
Yes.
Yeah, particularly if there's something. And so some physicians tend to... they're overconfidence.
That's a good way to...
On a variety of things. And yeah. Whether it's you're talking about picking a stock or investing in real estate or business ventures.
But it's not to be said for all
that's
physicians.
Absolutely. So we're not bashing all physicians.
The older the physician, the more experience, the more that they would actually agree with
the
what we're
saying. The more experience on?
Investing.
And having some losses.
And having some losses and understanding that there are risks that are
I think from an investment, so one of the best things that can happen is somebody has they can make a bad investment, not for a large amount, at a younger point in life.
It's
what your kids are doing.
Oh, I told him, I laughed at him, my oldest son, he's 20, and he was telling me what he was buying. He was buying these penny stocks, and he said, what do you think? And I said, I think this will be fun to watch. Don't ask me what I think about the stock. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, considering the majority of my firm's money is in index funds.
So I said, I have no idea. I don't think it's a good idea, but I don't know anything about that stock. And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, I think I'd rather watch you lose $3,000 on a bad investment now than $300,000 when you're 50. Assuming he has $300,000 when he's 50.
Or $3,000 now.
Well, he has $3,000 now.
Your 20-year-old?
Yes.
Oh, he's the one who worked and
he
sold
works
the
all
business.
The time.
And
he works
kid's hilarious.
Yeah, he works all the time. He works in college. In fact, big argument, college. Why only let him have one job? Why do I only have to have one job?
Now, your son was in the office, I think it was over the summertime. And... the way he asked me the question, I forget exactly what the question he asked, but it was pretty much, do you think I need to bother going back to school? He's halfway through college, right? Because you've said before, he just...
Oh, he wants to go to work. Anyway, that's enough about us. Let's talk about you at 888-2-HANSEN. That's 888-2-HANSEN. And we're going to talk with John. And John is joining us from, where's John joining?
Erie, Colorado.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you doing today, John?
If I get any better, they'll think I'm breaking the law.
There
is that
we
right?
go. That's a good line.
Yeah. That's good. That's all a good right. way to live.
And in Colorado, not a lot of laws to be broken.
No, not
too many.
Oh, well, California, we're with you now with the medical with the marijuana, not the recreational marijuana.
Recreational.
Yeah, we just voted that in, so now we're with you guys.
So what can we do for you?
Youth of America, so I don't do a whole lot of the recreational stuff, but
I'm just joking.
Wife and I are about 40, and I recently came across $10,000 as part of an estate gift from my grandparents, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
What do you recommend for it? What are your thoughts, first of all?
I'd like to do something that would be long term with it. I don't want to waste it. They were pretty great people and gave a lot of it to kids and grandkids as time went on. So I'd like to continue that wealth. I'd like to put it somewhere, forget about it, have it reinvest potentially on itself, and then 20 years from now when I've forgotten about it, be like, oh, yeah, what a wonderful thing.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah. And are these monies that did you inherit them or your spouse? You said you were married.
My parents inherited them, and then it was a gift to me.
Okay. Okay. And do you want to keep these dollars in your name?
Well, let's explain what happens. Well,
okay, yeah, what are my choices?
So what happens is money that is either gifted to you or inherited to you as an individual is considered separate property. It is not part of the marital asset. So what that means is that if you were to keep it in your own name, if something were to happen to your relationship with your spouse, you were to get a divorce, those assets would not be included in that marital asset, so you wouldn't have to split it up. If you put it in, and I'm trying to say this as nice as I possibly can without being offensive, if you put it in the name of both of you, then it becomes a marital asset. You've contributed to the marriage. And in most states, if you were to get a divorce in the future. So
we're not going to ask you
how your marriage is. I'm sure she sounds like a lovely lady. Scott, your wife inherited. Scott's wife inherited some money.
Years ago.
And what did you do?
Oh, I had it converted to my name immediately.
No, what did you do?
I kept it separate.
You kept it separate?
She actually ended up, it wasn't a ton, and she actually, over a period of time, ended up gifting it to some charities that were important to her. That's how she chose to do it. But that's besides the point. So let me ask you this question. Do you contribute to a Roth IRA?
I do.
Okay, are you maximizing that out?
I have been for the last 5 years, as has the wife. I was debating putting it in there because it's close to the $11,000 that we can put in individually.
But you're doing it anyway. So what's...
Right, and I'm usually just scrapping that together and making a one-time.
And I assume you don't have much debt.
I just refinanced the house at 15 years. I think I owe about $212 on it. I think it's worth.
It'll be paid off by the time you get retirement age or whatever. So then.
So
yeah.
And you inherit. You want to keep it. You want to put this somewhere, forget about it, and look at it in 20 years and remember this is a $10,000 gift that was in.
I know what I would do with this, Scott. What do you think you should do with it?
If it were me like this, I would buy a total stock market index fund, ETF.
Very low cost.
Super low cost. You're going to, with the total market, you're going to own about 5,000 different companies in there.
It's going to replicate most of the U.S. stock market.
Which is just giving you ownership of these companies.
It's going to
very tax efficient.
Spin off very little dividends and capital gains. And I love the idea.
Have the dividends and capital gains reinvested. You'll have a tiny bit to tax to report the early years, but.
And I'd keep it separate.
Okay.
I keep it separate.
Because it sounds like you're doing the other things well. I mean, unless there's something else we haven't uncovered, but you're already maximizing your Roth.
Which normally tells us that your 401k is. People that maximize the Roth. It's almost insulting to ask them if they've got excess other, debt.
Yeah, because you don't.
Because you're number.
You don't have $60,000 on credit card debt.
Yeah,
I'm guessing.
You're doing number five on the things you should do. The assumption is the other four things. So I'd go to a.
And that's where you were thinking the same thing, right?
Identical. Yeah. I don't know if I'd buy an ETF. I might even hold it right at a mutual fund company, and buy a total market.
Yeah,
right
it's
at
the
a
same
mutual
thing.
It's
they're
the
both
same
so
thing.
Cheap
they're
right
so
now.
Inexpensive.
An ETF is an electronic transfer fund, or
exchange traded fund.
Exchange traded fund.
Exchange traded fund.
But they're just, they're like,
it's the same thing.
It's almost the same thing.
It's almost, so even if you were to go.
I'd just go to one of the major discount
brokerage. I would go to a big discount brokerage, or I would go right to the mutual fund. Where do you have an account?
I've got accounts with Fidelity and with Schwab, because I've got some Nestle.
Yeah.
And so.
So what you could do is you could just add these dollars to that account.
Okay.
Buy a specific holding in there, and if I were in your situation, I'd buy a total stock market index.
Yes,
because you know, it's not, if it was $1 million, that something it's $10,000, and that way you can just remember this was from the money that was gifted me from my family, and I'm going to keep this separate.
And good enough. I wouldn't even open a new account. Too much hassle. Just buy it in an existing account.
And if I'm willing to take more risk, I'd love it to be $100,000 in 20 years or
you're not going to get much more risk than that.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
you could use a leveraged.
Yeah, you can borrow.
You can use the leveraged ETFs, but I wouldn't do that.
No.
I wouldn't do that. Hey, let me ask you a question. You said you mentioned two different accounts at two different firms. Why two different accounts? Why?
Because Fidelity will not automatically reinvest a Schwab's or a Nestle stock, being a Swiss company. And so I opened one originally with Fidelity. Interesting. And then, I guess it's not with Schwab, I'm sorry, it's with Capital One, I think, now. But they will not automatically reinvest the dividends. So I opened an account with the holder of the Nestle stock.
How much Nestle stock do you have?
A couple $1,000 worth, five.
Okay.
So
I okay.
Think.
All right. And I don't actually think you should, this is a different subject altogether, but it's my radio show. I don't think you should be reinvesting the dividends.
Because?
You might not want to buy it next week. And you could buy it anytime you want. So the reinvesting dividends actually defaults to the fact that you have to buy it, and you might not always want to buy it. Plus, it's harder to, well, they track the cost basis for you. But I don't see that. I don't see
okay.
that.
Okay, and I'm sort of more of a hands-off. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to play with it rarely. And so if
it's 6 1 half dozen the other, it's
all
right,
not going
to make a difference.
It's not going to. $2,000. But that's right. Anyway. All right, appreciate the call.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I will see what I can learn, and I hope you guys have a fantastic day and a wonderful California.
All right,
thanks,
John.
Thank you, John. Appreciate the call very much.
Bye-bye.
If you got a question for us, 1-888-2-HANSEN, 1-888-242-6766.
And we'll get you on the phone, and we'll do our best to help you.
Yeah, we would like to be of service. And
like
help.
We were with John. I think we helped him.
We might have helped him.
I don't know if he appreciated the Nestle comment, but who doesn't love?
Appreciated the Nestle comment.
Who doesn't love some Nestles?
Yeah, so. Well, now let's talk real advice. And this is a portion of our program where we talk with an advisor at Hanson McLean about a situation that somebody's in. And today we've got Patrick Henry.
And Scott, we have to give the disclaimer. So while this is a real-life story involving a real client whose name will not be used, it is not indicative of how your experience will go at Hanson McLean.
That's right.
Your experience could be better or far worse or far, far better.
Okay.
But.
So Pat Henry is a certified financial planner. He joined Hanson McLean in 1997. And
has it been that long?
I know, I was thinking the same thing. He works out of the Sacramento region, but he's one of the financial advisors here. Pat, welcome to Hanson McLean.
Thank you, guys. Yes, I am very old. So I've been around for a while.
You've been with
so
us.
So when
for,
we had the guest before, Encore.org, that was Pat's ears picked right
You've
up.
Been with us almost 19 years? Is that right?
No, not quite. Not quite.
Okay.
But sorry. All right.
So is this wrong? This note says 1997?
What time when did you start working with us?
2004.
Oh, this is wrong.
Just as Pat said. The disclaimer. May be accurate. We may provide accurate advice, maybe.
And
inaccurate.
Just for the,
I was reading that too. I didn't think it was that.
Yeah,
long.
I didn't think so. And just for the rest of the listeners, I worked at another firm with Pat Henry 26 years ago when I first started in the business, and we shared an office. Pat
That's
and I did.
That's right. We started back in, I started there in 1989. So
yeah.
I've been doing
All
it
right.
a while.
Good times.
You have been
Good
doing
times.
A while.
Wake the kids, call the neighbors. Anyway, okay. Let's move on to the meat of the story. You're going to tell us.
Yeah, part of this, we want to hear something that's kind of, sometimes there's something interesting out of the norm, but, the idea is for you to think, I wonder how this might apply in my own life. So that's continue.
Yeah, I think this is, yes, thank you. Thank you. I think this is kind of a little bit out of the norm of what we normally do. I've been working with this client about 2.5 years before her retirement. And at the end of last year, just trying to get her ready and make sure that she was, doing all the things that would create a successful retirement. And at the end of last year, she received an offer of a year's year's pay to basically retire a little bit early from her company. She worked for a large energy company down in the Bay Area. And so she decided to take it. She was in a good financial position. And so she retired at the end of last year. And at the beginning of this year, we were taking care of setting up her assets. She didn't really need any income at the time because she had this the severance package that was going to pay her for about a year. And she had a quite large 401k balance. And in the 401k balance, about a third of it was invested in company stock. And the company stock had a very low or relatively low cost basis in it. So one of the things that we wanted to look at was how could we get those dollars out of the 401k and reduce her tax liability as much as possible, because she is going to start taking income this next year. And so we wanted to have funds available for her to start generating an income from. So what we decided to do is we used what's called a net unrealized appreciation. It's a strategy where you can transfer your company stock out of the 401k into an after-tax brokerage account. And at the time you do that, you're going to pay ordinary income taxes on the cost basis, but any of that appreciation above the cost basis is taxed at capital gains rate when you decide to sell it. So you do not have to pay the taxes on that immediately. And the other benefit of it is it's all taxed at long-term capital gains rate, no matter when the capital gain was earned.
So, Pat, just as for the rest of the listeners, they're thinking,
besides the two of us listening to Pat Henry talking,
that understands what he's talking about. It's kind of a crazy concept, but if you work for a company, and these are typically Fortune 500
companies.
Yeah,
we've done this a number of times, so it's not an everyday thing.
But you come across it. And a good advisor will actually point it out to the client.
A good advisor.
And it worked well in this situation. You'd been meeting with this person a number of years prior to retirement.
So you said it was roughly $1 million account balance, right?
Correct. This is about a little over $300,000 stock position.
Okay. And what was the cost basis roughly?
Right, just under $100,000.
What that means is there's $300,000 in stock, not units, but stock in this person's 401k. They could sell that. They could take that stock out, take it out, have it distributed, and pay taxes on the $100,000, the $200,000 that was unrealized. The unrealized appreciation would not have to be recognized until they sold that, and then it would be taxed at a more favorable capital gains rate versus ordinary income tax.
Right, and based on her income bracket, we figured it was going to save her eventually about $30,000 in taxes.
Okay, so there's two risks here, right?
Plus, I'll say a couple other things. One is when the stock is held on the outside, the dividends that are paid from the company are qualified dividends at a lower tax rate. Plus, second, you don't have to worry about required minimum distributions. I mean, she had a pretty sizable account balance already.
So there are two risks, right? The one risk is that they change tax law and make capital gains higher taxes ordinary income, and then this whole exercise would have been for naught. But you wouldn't have hurt yourself. And the other risk is that you have a highly concentrated stock position. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say with this person, it was great because it's still highly it's still a large position, but it's only about 15% of her overall portfolio. Yeah.
And if it was highly concentrated as a percentage, let's say 40 or 50% of someone's portfolio, you can actually buy financial instruments to help mitigate some of that risk.
Yep. And the other kind of unique situation about using this strategy is once you start, you do have to liquidate the entire account within 12 months. And so what we did is we, in January, rolled out her funds and cash and positions in there over into an IRA. But because of the company, we felt the stock was underperforming based on what was happening in the economy. And this isn't something we would do all the time, but just looking at this, we said, I think this will probably do well going throughout the year. We left the stock in her 401k until about a week and a half ago. And then we just now transferred it over, and the stock grew about $16 a share over that time period. So now all of that capital gain will be treated as long-term capital gain no matter when she decides to sell the stock.
And Pat, did you share this with the person's accountant or accounting professional?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. We did discuss it. Yep.
And what was their read on this? Had they seen it before? Had they been using this sort of technique? Or they said, wow, how does this work?
It was, they had heard of it. They'd never had a client.
Really?
Yeah.
I think
I walked them through it.
I bet you I know some financial advisors listen to this program because I've met some of them. I bet there's some financial advisors listening right now that have not heard of net unrealized appreciation.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's not what you read. You typically don't read this in the tax disclosure on IRA on 401k distributions. And
the thing to remember, it has to be in unit. It has to be in shares. It can't be in units.
Can't be a phantom fund. Yeah. And frankly, a lot of 401ks, that's how they're structured.
Yeah.
You now, take your own units.
One last question, Pat.
Yeah.
Everyone that I've ever done in the past, the custodian kind of messed up the paperwork, did they?
No, actually, in this case, this was a large Fortune 500 company. They were they were on top of it. They kind of had done it in the past. The person I talked to, and they're the custodian of their 401k, is one of the larger ones, and they were on top of it as far as what we needed to do the transfer, where the cost basis was. They had tracked it, and so they did a good job.
No hiccups.
No hiccups. It went through very smoothly.
All right. Well, yeah. Thanks, Pat.
And thanks for being part of the Hanson McLean team for the last 12 years.
Yes.
Oh, it is my pleasure. My pleasure,
gentlemen. We appreciate you sharing the strategy, too. Thanks, Pat. All right, so, if you're out there and you've got a 401k that you've got company stock in that you've owned for a number of years and the stock's gone up in value and you're close to retirement, you really need to take a good look at the strategy. Sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, I've certainly looked at it at times for people when after we crunch the numbers, it doesn't make sense for whatever reasons. But I've seen other times when the cost basis is almost nothing.
So low that it would be crazy not to do it.
I've seen that sometimes on smaller companies where they have an ESOP plan.
Especially smaller, right? Privately held companies.
Yes, privately held companies that it's an ESOP plan that's been in existence for 30 years.
And this is a little bit more difficult because you have to use
it can be just a little more complicated. But it's worth – it can be well worth it. And so – we strongly recommend you talk with your financial advisor about it. If your financial advisor has not heard of net unrealized appreciation, find yourself another financial advisor. Seriously. So, anyway, we're getting close to the end of the program, which is always a sad time for us. But you can get this show every week if you simply – you can go to moneymatters.com, our website, and follow the links there. Or go to iTunes, search Hanson McLean. We suggest you rate us on iTunes as well. It certainly helps if you.
Yeah, we can't ask you to rate us favorably, but
that's true. And furthermore, if you've had yet to receive a copy of our book, go to moneymatters.com/book, and you'll have a coupon for 75% off when you buy it on Amazon.com. And it's our personal decision points about retirement transition. So this music means we are out of time. We'll see you next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. You've been listening to Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor or conduct your own due diligence.